The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The Biden cover-up, the COVID-19 cover-up, the Whitmer cover-up, one cover-up on top of another. Come on, man! This is the Dinesh D'Souza podcast.
America needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
Joe Biden has a trademark expression that he's been using for most of his career that sort of now defines his presidency. Do you know what it is? I bet you do. Certainly when you hear it, you'll know. Listen.
Is what they do worthwhile? Come on, man. 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 Come on, man.
Come on, man. Come on, man. Come on, man. Now, I think the thing about come on, man is that, well, first of all, it's an expression that you rarely hear adults to use. There's something kind of juvenile about it. It's the kind of thing you'd say on the playground. And in a sense, I suppose it's an appeal to a certain basic sense of fairness. You know, some guy takes your marbles. You know, you've taken all my marbles. Come on, man. Give me my marbles back. Or it's an appeal to the middle ground. Let's talk this through reasonably. In that sense, it's an appeal to moderation because it's an appeal to finding a way in which two people can kind of come to some sort of agreement. It's prodding the other guy to be reasonable. It's Aristotelian in this sense, an appeal to the golden mean, to some kind of middle ground. But of course, contrast the rhetoric and the kind of falseness of it with the radicalism of the Biden agenda. Biden rails daily against every effort at election integrity, every effort to try to make sure that the people vote who should be voting, who are eligible to vote, legal voters. He calls all of this stopping the election and blocking the election, ending the voting, and this kind of absurdity. Biden is trying to pack the court. He's got some bogus commission stacked with left-wing academics. I'll be talking more about that later in subsequent podcasts. We see ways in which they're trying to get around the filibuster. They're trying to create a federalized voting system that sort of subverts the constitutional structure of letting voting matters be settled by the state. So all these efforts by Biden and his team to push where even Clinton dare not go and Obama dare not go and certainly Jimmy Carter dare not go. So all of this is a break with the notion of finding common ground. And this come on, man, you might remember Biden used it in the debate against Trump. Trump would bring up Biden family corruption. Come on, man, as if to say, don't go there. There's nothing there. It's unreasonable to even raise the suggestion. And of course, the key to Biden's was whatever my son was doing, Hunter Biden, I wasn't part of it. I never met with anybody. I didn't have any direct connection with foreign leaders. I did not deal with the people who are funneling money to the Biden family. Now, we know from Hunter Biden's own testimony, as found on his laptop, that this isn't true. Hunter Biden says explicitly there was money reserved for the big guy. That's Joe Biden. He wanted his own percentage. He was in on it. So from the son, we know that the father was directly involved. But we didn't have independent confirmation that Biden himself was meeting with his son's corrupt business associates. But now we do. The work here has been done by Miranda Devine of the New York Post, and it's going to be in a forthcoming book. And I'm hoping to have Miranda on this program to talk more about her findings. But her article in the New York Post is a kind of a bombshell, which is that Hunter Biden brought Joe Biden to dinner with a whole slew of shady business partners. Now, what's important about this is that it puts Joe Biden right at the dinner table. Joe Biden, Hunter Biden, and the crooks are all sitting around the table. And we know this because it's also on Hunter Biden's laptop, and there's a photograph of Biden at this dinner. The dinner took place, by the way, at the Cafe Milano. I've eaten at Cafe Milano. It's kind of a one of those famous restaurants in Washington, D.C., kind of a mover and shaker type of place. The restaurant itself boasts that all kinds of important people eat there. There are photos of all kinds of presidents and senators having met there. So at this kind of power place, you have, who do you have? Well, you have Joe Biden and a whole bunch of Ukrainian, Russian, and Kazakhstan billionaires, mafia bosses, kind of the people who are funneling money into the Biden family. Now, this dinner we're talking about was held on April 16, 2015. It was at the private garden room at this restaurant. And we know that Joe Biden was there, not just from the photo, but after the dinner, Hunter Biden gets an email from a guy named Vadim Polarzyski, an executive of, well, the Ukrainian energy company Burisma. This is the exact company that was paying Hunter Biden $83,000 a month. Hunter Biden, who has no experience in energy, knows nothing about the Ukraine, is sitting on the board of this Ukrainian energy company and receiving almost $100,000 a month, well over, close to $1 million, more than $1 million a year. And by the way, his partner getting another $83,000 a month, also from Burisma. And here's the email from Vadim Polarski. He goes, "Dear Hunter, thank you for inviting me to D.C. and giving me an opportunity to meet with your father." So we know that now there's a direct meeting involving Burisma and Joe Biden. And spend some time together. It's really an honor and a pleasure. Now, before the dinner, Hunter prepares the guest list. And here's something very interesting. We know that this is a shady operation because Hunter even says, he's writing an email to another guy. And he says that he's structuring the dinner to pretend that this is a dinner that is connected to his role as a member of the board of World Food Program USA. Hunter sits on this board. Hunter's pretending like we're going to have a meeting to discuss issues of food, feeding hungry people around the world. Here's Hunter's email, by the way. I'm going to read it now. "Okay, the reason for the dinner is ostensibly means in pretense, is on the surface, to show. Okay, the reason for the dinner is ostensibly to discuss food security." And then he adds this critical line, "Dad will be there, but keep that between us." So Hunter Biden does not want it to be known that his father is in on the scheme. But his father was. And so the very fact that this dinner was not on the up and up, hey, yeah, we're having a dinner with a bunch of business guys, so what? No, they knew that this was a shady dinner. They knew that there were business dealings being discussed. The big man was present at the dinner. And let's see who was there. Mark Holzman, who was then the chairman of the Soviet Republic's largest bank. There was the corrupt former mayor of Moscow, who has, by the way, since died. But remember, this is the guy who sent this big fat check to Hunter Biden. Trump brought it up in the debate. The Russian billionaire Yelena Baturina and her husband were there. Devin Archer, it seems, the former advisor to Secretary of State John Kerry, was there. This is Hunter Biden's business partner, Devin Archer. So this is the Biden family racket. And what's so interesting is there it is, red-handed on Hunter Biden's laptop, details provided, dates provided, locations provided. You notice deadening silence from the media. No reporting on any of this whatsoever. And so the cover-up story prior to the election, which was remember the censorship on Twitter? Remember they were taking down any references to the idea of Hunter Biden's laptop, the idea of payments going to the Biden family. Now, later, the digital moguls like Jack Dorsey apologized. "We shouldn't have done that. That was really a mistake," you know. So he corrects the mistake, or at least acknowledges the mistake when it's too late, after there's anything, when nothing can really be done about it. But my point is that the wall of silence surrounding the Biden family's corrupt dealings, this is, by the way, what accounts for the Biden family lifestyle. The reason the Biden family has three homes, the reason that if you look at the net worths of Biden and his family, you see something very interesting. Biden's own net worth remains kind of stable. It shows kind of his gradual accumulation of wealth, but mainly through government salaries. But if you look at the Biden extended family, by the way, not just Hunter, but also the brothers, James Biden, for example, you see their net worth soar dramatically. And the reason is obvious. They don't have the same disclosure requirements as Joe Biden. So Joe Biden is on the up and up, but the family members are running the kind of Biden family Corleone operation, and of course funneling money back to dad, which dad himself gets to spend and enjoy this kind of multi-millionaire lifestyle that is inconceivable merely on a government salary. It's certainly not coming from Dr. Jill Biden's earnings either as a community college instructor. So bottom line of it is this family has been in on the take. They've been in on the take from Ukraine, perhaps from Russia, certainly from China. We also know from Costa Rica, from South America, they've been running a global racket. I think it was in some ways modeled on the Clinton racket. And just like the Clinton racket, it is protected by the media. It's almost as if you are a Democrat, you enjoy a certain complete immunity from public scrutiny. And by the way, that's what encourages these guys to think that they can do it, because they know they can get away with it, because they have been getting away with it, and they're still getting away with it. So there's a big cover-up underway. And if it wasn't for the reporting of people like Miranda Devine, it wasn't for the reporting of people who are blowing the whistle and getting the message out, we wouldn't know where the Biden family got all that money. The scandal continues to grow about the origins of COVID-19. And as for the Biden administration, there's a little bit of panic that is setting in. And they are doing their best to divert attention away from the issue at hand. Here is Zeke Emanuel, Biden's COVID advisor, saying why it doesn't really matter how this all got started. Listen.
Oh, the real issue is not how did this happen? The real issue is how do we protect ourselves from the next pandemic?
What the heck? The real issue isn't whether the Manson family killed, the Hollywood producer and all those people. The real issue is how do we prevent Hollywood producers and actors and their guests from being murdered in their homes in the future? No, that's not the real issue. The real issue is who did this? Who unleashed a global pandemic that has killed millions of people, close to a million in the United States alone? Who devastated the world economy? Who rebalanced the power structure between China and the United States? Who did that? Who's responsible for it? Was it some wayward bat that did bat droppings onto a cow, and then the cow's meat was eaten in a meat market? Was that the cause of it? It's becoming increasingly apparent that that was the lie that was promoted aggressively by the media, promoted aggressively by digital censorship, cutting out all alternative explanations. I mean, think about this. Facebook has evidently removed 18 million, quote, misleading posts about COVID-19 since the beginning of the pandemic. It has labeled or tagged more than 167 million others. And while Facebook is doing this in the name of stopping misinformation, we now realize that the notion that COVID-19 might have come out of a lab in Wuhan is not misinformation. It is, in fact, a legitimate and plausible, perhaps the most plausible, rival theory. So in calling it misinformation and banning it, Facebook itself was putting out misinformation. Think of how Orwellian this is. In the name of correcting misinformation, you become the primary transmitter of misinformation. Now, this is a huge scandal because, think about it. First of all, we have been listening for a year and more than a year, 15 months, to all these health specialists and virologists who have been telling us all kinds of stuff. Do this, don't do that. This works, that doesn't work. Don't wear a mask, wear a mask. I mean, Fauci is only the sort of tip of the iceberg of this whole community of experts who have been lecturing us about this disease. And not only lecturing us, hectoring us, bullying us, shutting things down based upon all this expert information. And now, guess what? it may be that this is exactly the group of people who gave us the disease, who made it, who literally manufactured it in a lab as a result of their collaborative work. They knew this work was extremely dangerous. They knew that if this virus gets out, viruses, by the way, more lethal than the viruses occurring in nature. They take lethal viruses, they make them more contagious, they make them more deadly. They knew the downside of this kind of research. But notice that for 15 months, they've told us nothing about it. In fact, if it hadn't come out, if it wasn't for Nicholas Wade's article, if it wasn't for Rand Paul's questioning of Dr. Fauci, all of this, we would still not know about it. We would still not know that the scientific community, in the name of research, has actually been cooking up deadly viruses. Here's a remarkable statement by Scott Gottlieb, MD. This is the former FDA commissioner. He says that lab leaks happen all the time. Happen all the time. He's quoted, by the way, saying this on Face the Nation, CBS News. And I'm now quoting him. These kinds of lab leaks happen all the time, actually. Even here in the United States, we've had mishaps. And here's the key line. And in China, the last 6 known outbreaks of SARS-1 have been out of labs. What? In other words, what he's saying is that there have been multiple previous occasions on which these cooked up viruses got out of the lab and caused many people to get sick, if not die. So it could very well be now, and I think this is now becoming the prevalent theory, that COVID-19 was manufactured. It was done not by nature, it was done by man, by some very arrogant men who did not take the necessary precautions. Now, the question, the big question, is why did they not take the necessary precautions? Now, here's another telling line by Scott Gottlieb. He basically says, we need to also look at public health through the lens of national security. This was an asymmetric event in its harm to the United States. COVID hurt the U.S. a lot more than it hurt many other countries. Now, what he's getting at, very important, is that when you have an event that produces a rebalancing of power between major countries, in this case between China and the United States, you have to ask the question, was it truly an accident? Was it just a case where, oops, the virus got out, and oops, it hurt the other guy, and oops, it benefited me? Or is it the case that the virus was let out, that somebody thought it might be good to put out the virus? This will help defeat Trump, for example, or this could have other benefits in that it could cause a kind, it could ravage the world economy in such a way that we, China, will come out on top in the end. This could be, if it turns out to be, that China made this virus, and if it turns out to be that we helped to fund it, and if it turns out to be that they might have released it deliberately as a biological weapon, think about that. Think of what this would unleash worldwide. Think about the impact. This would be, quite honestly, the biggest scandal, I can't just say of the 21st century, because the 21st century is only 21 years old. It would be the biggest scandal, perhaps, of the last 100 years. Certainly of my lifetime. A bigger scandal, to be honest, than the 2020 election. And here's something Debbie said that kind of caught my attention. She goes, maybe the two scandals might be connected. Maybe they're part of the same scandal. Maybe in some ways what happened in the election, because think about it, a lot of the things that happened in the election were done in response to COVID. That's why we had the millions of mail-in ballots that went out. So is it possible that we are looking at the plot thickens in the sense that we're dealing with something that is truly unimaginable levels of malevolence, corruption, and we can safely say public deception. So the Biden people are pretending to investigate this. Our intelligence community is going to go to the bottom of this. Really, why haven't they already? What access does our intelligence community have to what happens inside the Wuhan lab what happened there before, or the connections between the Wuhan lab and the Chinese government. The simple truth of it is, and trust me on this, we're going to get some bogus whitewash report. Unnamed officials told other unnamed officials who told other unnamed officials. And the bottom line of it is it will clear the Biden administration of any responsibility. Why? Because these intelligence committees are now bogus. They're in the pocket of the Democratic Party. They are arms of the left. They're not genuine intelligence operations. Our trust in them should be absolutely zero. So this is a major cover-up in the works. And even though China may have done grievous harm to the United States, it's very clear that the Biden administration intends to do about it precisely nothing. I was just recently talking to Mike Lindell, and he is organizing a huge rally. This is coming up, not this weekend, but next weekend. And Trump's going to be there, and Diamond and Silk, of course, Lindell, he invited me to speak. My daughter Danielle will be there also. And afterwards, I was thinking to myself, hey, it's really important for us to support guys like this who go out front and put themselves on the line. So I've come up with a new idea, not to really persuade you to support Mike. I don't think I need to do that, but to encourage you to go all out on this. So I'm going to call this the Dinesh Book and Movie Deal. And I haven't even mentioned it to Mike. He knows nothing about it so far. Here's the deal. You go all out and buy a whole bunch, $250 or $500 or $1,000 of MyPillow merchandise. Now, this is not hard to do. Why? Because this guy, Mike, has more than 100 great products, from his classic premium pillows to the Giza Dream sheets to the MyPillow robes, the MyPillow mattress topper, the MyPillow dog beds. The list goes on. Now, here's the fun part. If you spend $250, I'm going to send you a signed copy of one of my recent books, one of my favorites, personally autographed to you. If you spend $500, you get two signed books plus two of my movies. If you spend $1,000 or more, this is sort of the grand prize, you get four signed books and four movies, a kind of mini Dinesh collection. So let's show Mike what we can do for him and get some great books and movies in the bargain. Call 800-876-0227 or go to MyPillow.com and use promo code Dinesh. Now, what else do you have to do to get the books? Nothing. I'll get the information from the MyPillow people. I'll send the books and the movies to the same address that you use for your merchandise. The offer ends July 4th. Again, that phone number, 800-876-0227 or go to MyPillow.com. But you must use promo code D-I-N-E-S-H, Dinesh. You've heard about the Cuomo scandal involving nursing home debts. This is Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, deliberately pushing COVID-19 positive patients into nursing homes against the objection of those nursing homes, where elderly people, particularly vulnerable to getting COVID, get it and die. Now, in New York, there were 15,000 nursing home deaths. And the governor, partly in order to promote a book, partly in order to keep his image as the kind of the greatest, the most effective, true leadership in dealing with COVID, this guy reported only 8,700 deaths. He hid almost 50% of all the nursing home deaths in New York. And he did this through a network of lies and bullying people and preventing people from reporting the truth. And all of this has now come out. And there's an investigation, in my mind, a bogus investigation, but nevertheless underway on this. Now, turns out there is a very similar scandal brewing in Michigan involving Governor Whitmer. Same story. Pushing coronavirus patients into nursing homes and basically killing the people over there. Now, let's look at what we know about this. Turns out that there have been 19,000 deaths in Michigan, out of which 5,600 were in these nursing homes. Now, the problem is that when you look at the data of the Michigan deaths, you basically realize, first of all, that these nursing homes are... they're not checked in terms of deaths occurring there. There's a sort of a vague kind of honor system that nursing homes kind of report deaths when they kind of get around to it. They're sort of obliged scout's honor to do it. Because remember, people don't necessarily die in the nursing home. You're in the nursing home, you get really sick, you're transferred to a hospital, you die in the hospital, but it's a nursing home death because that's where you got COVID. But the nursing home may or may not report it. Turns out that the Michigan Health Department has a whole bunch of deaths that are completely unaccounted for. In fact, 6,945. They are listed as, quote, vital records reviews. Now, what does that mean? That basically means that Michigan health officials, in going over the data, have found death certificates of 6,945 people dead of COVID, but don't know where they came from. Now, you would think, as in New York, pretty easy to figure out where they came from. All you have to do is look at the death certificate. Remember, a typical death certificate lists the cause of death, but it also lists where the person is staying, where they came from. It lists their address. And so if the address says St. Catherine's Nursing Home, to just make up the name of a nursing home, you'd be like, wow, that's a nursing home death right there. But Michigan health officials refuse to do this audit. They refuse to actually check to see how many of these 6,945 deaths can be traced to Michigan nursing homes. Why aren't they doing it? Because that, of course, would push the nursing home debt total even higher. Now, there is a research group in Michigan called the Mackinac Center, and they decided, all right, why don't we do our own study of these debt certificates and try to look and see, based on a kind of representative sample, how many of them come from nursing homes. And what they found is it's about 45%. In other words, close to half of all these anonymous deaths can be traced to nursing homes. What this means, if you think about it, is if there are 6,945, let's just say 7,000 unaccounted for deaths, using the rough math of 50%, probably another 3,500 deaths can be attributed to nursing homes. So we've got 5,600 deaths already. Add another 3,500 and you get over 9,000 deaths. So once again, what's happening in Michigan, very similar to New York, they're hiding the bodies. They're not revealing the data. So look, it's one thing to say that Gretchen Whitmer made a horrible decision in dispatching these patients to nursing homes. That's a bad public policy decision. That's a public policy decision driven by ignorance of how you get COVID, who's most vulnerable, and so on. But what's even worse is you don't provide public transparency. Having made a mistake, you try to now smuggle away the data so that people who are scrutinizing what's going on with the government can't find out where these deaths came from. So the bottom line of it is we're now seeing, and thank God, this is the good news, this is the silver lining, there are recall petitions brewing against, well, not against Governor Cuomo, but against Governor Newsom in California. And there's a recall petition against Whitmer that is collecting signatures in Michigan. A judge just ordered that this recall petition is valid and it can move ahead if it gets the adequate number of signatures. We're putting Gretchen Whitmer, you may say, on the political chopping block, and it couldn't be a moment too soon. How did you choose which internet service provider to use? The sad thing is most of us have very little choice because service providers operate like monopolies in the regions they serve. Then they use this monopoly power to take advantage of customers. Data caps, streaming throttles, the list goes on. Worst of all, many service providers log your internet activity and sell that data on to other big tech companies or advertisers. Now, to prevent service providers from seeing my internet activity, I protect all of my devices with ExpressVPN. So what is ExpressVPN? Well, it's a simple app for your computer or smartphone that encrypts all your network data and tunnels it through a secure VPN server so that your service provider cannot see any of your activity. Just think about how much of your life is on the internet. Sadly, the list of people you've messaged, sites you've visited, videos you've watched, all gets tracked by tech giants who can then sell your information for profit. That's the reason I recommend ExpressVPN as the best way to hide your online activity from your service provider. You just download the app, tap one button on your device, and you're protected. And I can do it, so can you. Stop handing over your personal data to service providers and other tech giants who mine your activity and sell off your information. Protect yourself with the VPN I trust to keep me private online. Visit expressvpn.com/Dinesh. That's expressvpn.com/Dinesh. You get 3 extra months free. Go to expressvpn.com/Dinesh. The left and the Democrats are really nervous about election integrity laws that are now passing in a whole bunch of important states. Florida passed one. Texas is on the verge of passing a big one. The Democrats staged kind of a walkout in Texas to delay the Texas integrity law, but it's going to become law. And already the left is screaming about it. So here's Beto O'Rourke kind of skateboarding into the limelight and telling us why Texas voter integrity reminds him of Jim Crow. Listen.
It's worth remembering that our democracy is the exception and not the rule in world history. And the exception on the planet today, and as hard fought as this democracy was won, we could so easily lose it with provisions like this one. But I also want to call attention to some of these seemingly innocuous provisions, like closing polling places in Texas or quote unquote standardizing elections. You know, the poll tax 100 years ago was somewhat innocuous sounding. The literacy test, the counting the number of jelly beans in a jar. But in every instance, they were used to try to stop Black Texans and African Americans throughout the former Confederacy from being able to use their rights to vote.
Well, I'll address the issue about the poll tax and Jim Crow in a moment. But let me start with, you know, it's funny with these guys like Beto. They make authoritative assertions. Our democracy, even today, is the exception around the planet. The basic idea is that most of the world, I guess he thinks, is made up of these autocracies, and there just aren't very many democracies to go around. And the first question is that even true? So I look it up. I pull up some data from the Pew Research Center. At the end of 2017, 96 out of 167 countries with populations of at least 500,000 were democracies, and only 21, 13% were autocracies. There's a bunch of countries that are seen as having elements of both democracy and autocracy. But my point is, there's a clear majority of regimes in the world that are democratic. That's the case of our world today. In fact, scholars have talked about waves of democratization. And there was a third wave of democratization late in the 20th century. It really began in the 1970s with democratization occurring in places like Greece and Portugal and Spain. And by the way, also Chile, where the Pinochet dictatorship gave way to democratization in Chile. Then there was a massive wave of democratization in Latin America in the 1980s, and most of that continent, which was traditionally run by these caudillo dictatorships, has now become democratic. Not all of it, of course, but most of it. And then with the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was a massive spread of democracy throughout Eastern Europe in the 1990s. Bottom line, this is what has produced a tilt in the world toward democracy. Beto evidently knows none of this. He can just confidently assert something that turns out to be blatantly untrue. Now, let's look at the Jim Crow restrictions. By the way, restrictions all promoted by the Democratic Party. This is the one fact you never hear when they're warning about, oh, we're really worried about, you know, going back to the bad old days of the past. The first thing to say to them is those bad things that you're referring to were done by your party. Why don't you start by mentioning that? They never do. But those Jim Crow restrictions, poll taxes, literacy tests, counting the jelly beans in a jar, as if that's what Texas is making people do now. No, all those things were just blocking mechanisms to prevent people from voting. They had nothing to do with voter authentication. They had nothing to do with establishing voter integrity. By contrast, look at things like the voter ID requirement. How does the voter ID requirement resemble a poll tax? A poll tax basically says if you don't have the money, you can't vote because you got to pay to vote. It's a whole different thing to say you have to establish yourself as an eligible voter to vote. Two different things. Or consider, for example, the idea of taking a literacy test implies you have to have a certain level of education to vote. That's a whole different thing from saying things like, you can't just collect massive, you can't just blow out a whole bunch of millions of mail-in ballots and just collect what comes back in the mail and assume that those are all legitimate votes. No, these are not the same things at all. So what the left is doing here is taking the crimes of the Democratic Party and somehow magically foisting them onto the Republican Party and implying that we, the Republicans, are the same crooks that they were in the past and that we're imposing voter integrity requirements for the same nefarious reasons that they impose not voter integrity, but voter blocking requirements. There's really no equation between the evils they did and the good things that we are trying to do now. Now, here's another Texas Democrat. This is Mark Allison, VC, talking about the kind of election fraud that I think he wants to prevent. He goes, otherwise, we're going to become Venezuela. Listen.
And that's not something that happens in our country. That's something that you think about happening, you know, in Zimbabwe or Venezuela or some other country that's not industrialized and has issues dealing around freedom and democracy.
Okay. you should have heard Debbie when she played this clip. I had to literally keep her like pinned down to the floor because she's like, doesn't this guy realize that precisely by refusing to do any kind of checking, by allowing election fraud to become systematized in Venezuela, this is exactly how every election since 2004 has been rigged? So if this guy's worried about becoming Venezuela, the truth of it is the absence of voter integrity laws. It is the absence of making sure that eligible voters are the only ones who vote and the votes are counted properly. It is the failure to do that. In fact, it is the deliberate decision of the Chavez and then Maduro regime to ensure that that was not done. That's how they were able to establish, you could call it, a permanently rigged system. So the Democrats, in claiming to disavow the Venezuelan model, are actually the most active champions of it. If you're considering replacing your carpets due to pet stains and odors, you gotta try Genesis 950. The reviews are incredible. This is one product that actually works. With water, it breaks down the bonds of stains and odors so they are gone for good. Its antibacterial component removes pet odors from carpet and padding. It can be used in a carpet cleaning machine, and it's green, so it's safe for your family and pets. Genesis 950, made in America. 1 gallon of industrial-strength Genesis 950 makes up to 7 gallons of cleaner. But Genesis 950 is also great for bathrooms, for floors, upholstery, and grease stains. Debbie uses it to clean the entire kitchen, and when I got chocolate on the couch and on my pants, Genesis 950 took it right off. Genesis 950 has great customer service. Order 1 gallon direct at genesis950.com to receive a free spray bottle, free shipping, and a $10 coupon code using the code Dinesh. That's genesis950.com. Coupon only available for 1 gallon purchase. Genesis 950. It's much cheaper than replacing your carpets or your couch or your pants. Are Republicans losing confidence in democracy, by which I mean in constitutional democracy? According to an op-ed by Catherine Rampell in the Washington Post, we are. Her article is titled, "Republicans Are Sprinting Away from Democracy." And she goes on to say that there have been all these surveys of Republicans. And she says, the most troubling results came from a question about the party's best strategy for winning in the future in 2022 and 2024. People were asked, should the Republican Party focus on developing a message and popular policies and ideas? Or should they focus on prioritizing changes to the voting rules in various states and districts? And about half of Republicans said the latter. And Catherine Rampell jumps on this and goes, in other words, nearly half of those who still identify as Republicans appear to have given up on a key premise of democracy, that you earn the right to govern by proposing ideas that appeal to a majority of the public. Instead, she says, they prefer to short-circuit that process by making it harder for opponents to vote. Now, this is a very serious charge, and of course, Catherine Rampell is far from being the only one to make it. This notion that the Republicans are against democracy resonates with the whole critique of January 6th, and it's part of this larger idea that the Democrats are the only ones standing up for democracy, and the Republicans are against democracy. So I want to meet the charge head on. First of all, why is it the case that half of Republicans think that, quite apart from making a more popular agenda and appealing to the public, they need to fix, the country needs to fix its voting processes? Well, the reason that half of Republicans think that is that half of Republicans believe that the Democrats the last time around didn't focus on the campaign. They focused on controlling the processes of the election itself. They focused on the mail-in ballots and all this litigation of forcing districts to mail these ballots out en masse. They maintained full control of the vote counting machines. They stopped the count when the vote didn't seem to be going their way, resumed the count when they were ready. They blocked people from having close observation of what was going on. You couldn't really see what was happening with the ballots. So the Democrats maintained a kind of close control of the voting process. Meanwhile, what were Republicans doing? Having rallies, campaigning, making their case to the American people. So a lot of Republicans go, wait a minute, maybe we had the wrong focus. Maybe while we were focusing on selling our ideas, the other guys were focused on controlling the process of the count. So we need to fix the process to make sure that it's fair. We need to fix the process to make sure that legitimate votes are being counted and only legitimate votes. Now, more broadly, if you object to a process that you think is fatally flawed, it's kind of like saying, I'm a cyclist and I object to cyclists who are doping while participating in races. People can say, well, you're against cycling. You're against the very cycling process. No, I'm not against the cycling process, but in order to have a fair race, we got to make sure that all the competitors are legit. And that's what's going on here with the voting process. We're trying to make sure that the voters who vote are legit. The second point I want to make is that constitutional democracy is not democracy pure and simple. It's not democracy that simply says the majority rules, the majority has its way in everything. By the way, when the British rebelled against their kings, they replaced the authority of the king with the authority of the people, believing that in doing so, they had solved the problem of tyranny. Why? Because it's no longer one man who's in charge, it's now the many who are in charge. Part of the genius of the American founders was to realize that you could have tyranny either way. You can have the tyranny of the one, or you can have what the founders called the tyranny of the majority, the tyranny of the many. The people can be just as despotic as a monarch. Here's a quote from Jefferson. An elective despotism is not what we fought for. For Jefferson, you can have a despotism established by an elected majority. And the reason our constitutional system has all these checks and balances, all these efforts to, you may say, prevent one team from gaining absolute power, even a majority. The reason we have individual rights that are named in the Bill of Rights as protected from majorities. The reason we have courts whose job it is to protect those individual rights against legislatures, which is to say, quoting Joseph Story now, the great jurist, against the people themselves. The reason we have all this is because the American founders realized that power has to be dispersed to avoid the risk of tyranny. Minority rights are just as legitimate as majority rights. The majority does have the right to rule, but within certain enumerated and confined parameters. The bottom line of it is, I don't think Catherine Rampell has any sense of this. To her, any efforts to identify legitimate voters is proving to be an attack on democracy. Basically, the more people who vote, the better, and never mind who exactly is doing the voting, and never mind that there's no careful scrutiny to make sure that the people participating in the race, the cyclists, by my analogy, there's no effort to make sure that these cyclists are appearing at the race without having taken all kinds of drugs, without ultimately having rigged the system in their behalf. and any efforts to reform the cycling race, any efforts to make sure the competitors are all legitimate, is somehow seen as an attack on the process, an attack on cycling. These people have lost faith in cycling itself. No, we haven't. We believe in cycling. We believe in democracy. But we believe in constitutional democracy, and we will continue, regardless of all these preposterous accusations, to make sure that this democracy works the way the founders set it up to work. I don't know if you know this, but in April alone, consumer prices increased by 4.2%, the highest bump since 2008. Higher fuel prices, higher food prices, construction costs, housing prices. Inflation isn't just coming, it's here. Have you protected your savings, your investments? If you have not yet diversified a portion into precious metals, the answer is no. Now, for years, actually decades, I never invested in gold, just the stock market. But now I'm seriously worried about the regime we have in Washington. Absolutely no sense of fiscal responsibility. So listen, if all your investments are tied to greenbacks, you're sitting on a bit of a ticking time bomb. Invest a portion of your savings into gold and silver. Birch Gold Group is who I purchased from and who you can trust to convert an IRA or eligible 401k into an IRA backed by gold and silver. That's right, through a little known tax loophole, you can convert your retirement savings tied to the stock market into an IRA backed by precious metals. It's your hedge against inflation. Text Dinesh to 484848 for your free information kit on precious metals IRAs or to speak with a Birch Gold representative today. With 10,000 customers, an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, and countless five-star reviews, Birch Gold can help you too. Text Dinesh to 484848 and invest in gold like I did before it's too late. This past weekend, Debbie and I did a getaway to, well, the great state of Florida. And why Florida? Well, not just because Florida has Ron DeSantis. No. It's because Florida has beaches.
And sun.
And sunshine. And Debbie, well, my nickname for her is she's the island girl. And I think what she loves to do is feel the little pressing of sand between her toes and kind of gaze out over the ocean. And so we stayed in this beautiful hotel. We went to Naples, Florida. Beautiful place, by the way. And I was just thinking about, you know, kind of luxuriating in this hotel with all its magnificent lobby and all the kind of facilities, which are, by the way, in pretty full flower in Florida. They don't have the cramped kind of COVID feel that you have in much of the rest of the country. But I was thinking about the hotel itself. Now, Debbie and I have some favorite hotels. We travel a lot partly when I do speaking or conferences or meetings with people. We have certain favorite hotels. By the way, one of our favorites is the Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C. Another is the Peninsula Hotel in Los Angeles. But I was thinking about the hotel itself, and I remembered something that I read in this book, a remarkable book, by the way. It's called The Americans, The National Experience. It's by Daniel Boorstin, who used to be a Librarian of Congress. And he has a whole section in here about hotels. And he makes the point that the hotel is kind of an American institution. Americans invented hotels. There were no hotels really before America. And he makes the point that in England, there were, going back all the way to the Middle Ages, there were taverns, which are kind of drinking places, a tavern. And then there were inns. And the inn is a kind of a small, modest place where you can kind of room for the night. So the British had these small residential hotels, I suppose you could call them, but the hotel, by which I mean the spectacular structure, the palatial edifice, this was an American invention. And in fact, when English travelers, going back to the 19th century, would come to America, they were sort of stunned to see these hotels. One of the things that they noticed is that the hotels were not structured, they weren't laid out in kind of well-trodden places where people traveled. In England, by and large, if you're traveling, let's say, between, you know, London and the countryside, there might be along the way an inn where you can stop kind of on your way to go to, let's say, Bristol or wherever. But in America, the English travelers noticed that you might go into the wilderness and then in the middle of nowhere, a spectacular hotel. I want to read Anthony Trollope, the famous British writer, is traveling in the 1860s, And he writes this. He goes, "Hotels in America are very much larger and more numerous than in other countries. They're to be found in all towns, and I may almost say in villages." He then says that in England, you have the inn, which is positioned by and large between, let's say, two cities or two areas where people frequent. But he goes, "But in the United States of America, the first sign of an incipient settlement is a hotel five stories high with an office, a bar, a cloakroom, three gentlemen's parlors, two ladies' parlors, a ladies' entrance, and 200 bedrooms. And he goes, "Who's staying in this hotel? There's nobody around." He's making a very subtle point, which is he's making the point that in other countries, you have development, human development. And then when the development reaches a certain point, the city reaches a certain number of residents, the level of commerce and the economy becomes strong enough, they build some kind of an inn or some kind of a small hotel. He goes, in America, it's the opposite. They build the hotel first. It's kind of like the railroads. They built the railroads where no people were. And because they built the railroads, towns and later cities began springing up where the railroads were. Similarly, the idea is that you have people who come to a place, they want to build a kind of city, or they want to take a small town and expand it into a great city. And so what do? They commission a massive hotel. This is what happened, for example, in places like Boston. It happened in Chicago. You have innovators who say, "I want to build a city and we'll begin by build." It's sort of like you build it and people will come. Now, the American hotels were also centers of massive commercial innovation. Many of the things that are in your home and my home, ordinary conveniences that we take for granted, were first placed in hotels. So the hotel became sort of the testing ground. Let's look at a couple of examples of what I'm talking about. So it used to be that there were no elevators in America. And there were no elevators in American hotels either. So in American hotels, by and large, the most expensive rooms were on the ground floor. The second most expensive rooms were on the first floor. The third most expensive rooms were on the second floor. Why? Because you had to walk up and you had to carry your luggage up. So one of the first things that hotels introduced, long before they were introduced into condos and private buildings, was the idea of the elevator. And the elevator, of course, transformed the hotel where now the most expensive rooms were on the top floor. Hotels also were the original place where people would do their banking. Hotels had little banking centers, which then gave way later to private banks in their own separate buildings. Hotels also were sort of an information center where people exchanged information. In fact, the hotel registry was one of the first places where people would say where they came from and, believe it or not, who they voted for in the last election. So the whole science of polling, which became a separate industry later, began with people literally noting who they voted for on the hotel guest book. Hotels also had the first reading rooms in America. And so you'd have a hotel, and inside the hotel, you'd have this sort of parlor or reading room. The hotel would subscribe to newspapers from all over America, later all over the world. And by and large, people who were patronizing the hotel could sit there and have a mini library at their disposal. This is not to mention the great innovations in plumbing, in heating, in ventilation, in air conditioning, and also in architecture. So hotels basically introduced concepts like central air, central heat. Private homes at one time didn't have it's not just they didn't have the means, they didn't have the technology to be able to introduce these things. As they became available, hotels jumped on them. Hotels were like, "Yeah, we'll take it." And so the telephone. Initially, there were very few private telephones. The hotels had the telephone system to be able to communicate between rooms and also to be able to make calls out from the hotel. So the telephone exchange was a central location. And then you had all these phones in the hotels, which then later spread out to people having phones in their private homes and so on. So where I'm going with all this is that the hotel is a grand American institution. And when I think about the hotels, it's also they're also very democratizing, by which I mean that if you think about it, a very rich guy, a guy like Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos, they can have a palatial home which has a gigantic $100,000 chandelier and all this, these sort of this impression of grandeur. And they live that way. They maybe conceal it from the public, but that's how they live. Well, the hotel allows the ordinary guy on a getaway for a weekend or perhaps for a week on vacation to have to sit in a lobby, which is not his own lobby. He's not Jeff Bezos. But on the same time, his lobby, quite frankly, is just as grand as anything that Jeff Bezos can put in his own house. And so it gives ordinary Americans a taste of what otherwise would be only available to the fabulously rich. You may say that the privileges of aristocracy become democratized in America through this peculiarly American institution called the hotel. Earlier, I mentioned my special Mike Lindell deal, so take advantage of it. Here I want to talk about Mike Lindell's incredible bed sheets. He's found the best cotton in the world in a region where the Sahara Desert, the Nile River, and the Mediterranean Sea all come together to create the ideal weather conditions for growing cotton. His new Giza Dream bed sheets are made with this long staple cotton, and Mike guarantees they'll be the most comfortable sheets you ever own. The first night you sleep on them, you're not going to want to sleep on anything else. The Giza Dream sheets are available in a variety of colors, like all of Mike's products. 60-day money-back guarantee, 10-year warranty. So right now, buy one, get one free by calling 800-876-0227 and use promo code Dinesh. For a limited time, buy one, get one free. Call 800-876-0227 or go to mypillow.com, but make sure to use promo code Dinesh. It is said that you can't judge a book by its cover, and leaving aside the metaphorical meaning of that phrase, the simple truth of it is that when you buy a book, you do judge it by its cover. In particular, you judge it by its title. The title is what conveys what the book is about. You obviously haven't read the book in advance before you pick it up or buy it. You might have heard a little bit about it, but you look at the title and you look at the cover. And so I think as an author myself, I'm now up to, I don't know what, honey, 17 books, something like that. Mm-hmm. I'm working on my 18th book. And I think a lot about book titles because I realize how important they are in conveying what makes this book distinctive, what makes it unique. And I've been sort of chuckling a little bit at book titles. I just came across one, Fauci's writing a book. Ha! Apparently his book is, it's titled, it supposedly is about his life philosophy, which I'm curious what that is. But the book is called Expect the Unexpected. Think about that. First of all, if you expected it, it wouldn't be unexpected. I mean, I think to myself, okay, what do you mean when you say expect the unexpected? Here are some unexpected events I thought of off the top of my head. Human beings will grow noses in the back of their heads. That would be unexpected. Should I expect that? Animals will learn to talk and tell jokes. That's unexpected. Should I expect that? Joe Biden will get his brain back and start composing lengthy, lucid sentences.
Come on, man.
No, come on, man. It's too short. He would say he would be expostulating in Shakespearean fashion. I mean, that would be unexpected. I'm not going to be expecting that one. Burundi will take over the world. Its main rival will be the little country of Liechtenstein. Expect the unexpected. Stupid stuff. I'm reading actually a very good book right now. It's by the philosopher Martin Gardner. And I'm mentioning it only to focus on the title, which kills me. The Whys of a Philosophical Scrivener. What a title! I mean, who came up with this title? Martin Gardner, what were you thinking? Were you thinking something like this? Well, you know, I wonder what I should title this book. I'm kind of a scrivener. And I like to ask the question why, so maybe I'll call the book The Whys of a Philosophical Scrivener. Well, if you're going to do that, Martin Gardner, you may as well go all the way with, how about, did you consider the confessions, the cogitations of an autodidact? Did you consider the peregrinations of an omphaloskeptic? By the way, omphaloskepsis is the art of staring into your own navel. That's omphaloskepsis. So an omphaloskeptic is somebody who likes to do that. Many years ago at the American Enterprise Institute, I came across a book with what is, to my mind, the worst title of any book ever written. The author, whom I know, a really good guy, and by the way, a really good book, but the book is killed by its title. Here's the title: Tranquilitas Ordinis. Really? Was this a book that the author intended to find actual readers for? You have to know the Latin meaning of the title to even show interest in the topic. Tranquilitas, which I guess means peace. Ordinis, order, so peace through order or through law. This is what the author was getting at, but what a title! A friend of mine, Michael Novak, wrote a book on liberation theology many years ago. He simply titled the book, Will It Liberate? Without explaining quite clearly in the title what the it was. Now, here are some really good book titles. William F. Buckley, God and Man at Yale. That sums it up, and that's arresting. God and Man at Yale. It tells you a lot about what Buckley is going to talk about. Alan Bloom, The Closing of the American Mind. Again, it conveys the theme of the book. A beautiful book written by Peter Laslett many years ago, The World We Have Lost. He talks about what England was like before the Industrial Revolution. A biography of Vince Lombardi, the great coach, which was published in the Clinton years and became a bestseller, I think, solely because of the title. The title was When Pride Still Mattered. And because Clinton was such a pervert and everyone was feeling kind of dirty about the Clinton scandals, a book called When Pride Still Mattered was all it took to people go, wow, let me go get that. Let me hearken back to a better age than the sordid era we're living in which with this creep in the White House. Bottom line, and I know I say, you know, I realize I kind of say bottom line a lot. Debbie's been like, bottom line tonight? Does every segment have to end with like, bottom line? I'm going to try to do a little bit less of the bottom lining at the end of my segments. This is how I become a real skilled podcaster. I won't give you the bottom line. I'll just basically give you the heart of the matter, or I'll call it something else. Part of writing a book is figuring out how to sell it, how to find its audience. And in that process, it seems to me the book title is a critical component of saying in plain English, not in Latin, not in Greek, not in Hindustani, what your book is actually about. For many Americans, Father's Day is a day to celebrate, but for many others, it's a day to get through, because Father's Day hurts if you don't have a father. Now, the facts are clear. Fatherlessness drives many bad outcomes in America, from teen pregnancy to incarceration. An astounding 85% of youths in prison come from fatherless homes, 20 times the national average. But there is a path forward from the grim statistics. This is why I urge you to order a powerful new film called The Streets Were My Father. It features the journey of three inner-city Chicago men from fatherlessness to gangs and from life in prison to prison ministry programs that set them on the road to redemption. And they live as productive members of society. Here is a short clip. Listen.
I desired to have a father who would tell me that what I did was wrong.
Debbie and I both saw this movie. It's very moving. To see this important and inspirational film, the streaming version and DVDs, go to salemnow.com. That's SALEMNOW.com. You can buy a copy or copies for anyone you know who doesn't have a father or doesn't believe in the power of God to change lives. Go to salemnow.com. That's SALEMNOW.com. It's time for our mailbox. By the way, if you want to send questions, audio or video preferably, send them to questiondinesh@gmail.com. Let's go to today's question. Listen.
Hey, Dinesh. My name is Faith, and I have a question for you regarding the 10th Amendment. The federal government is attempting to legislate on matters that arguably should be left up to the states, such as trans rights for kids, gun rights, etc. The Constitution, as laid out in the 10th Amendment, doesn't seem to suggest that any of these should be handled on a federal level. In light of this, what matters do you think are truly under the authority of the federal legislature?
The Constitution, we have to remember, was not a pact among individuals. It was a pact among the states. The states came together to create the Union. And there was a division of power right from the very beginning between the federal government or the central government and the states. This principle of division, by the way, is called federalism. Madison described our American system, our constitutional system, as partly federal and partly national, by which he meant some of the power goes to the states and some of the power is retained by the Union. Now, interestingly, the Constitution enumerates or specifies the power of the federal government, and then it says in the 10th Amendment that while these powers specified in elsewhere in the Constitution are reserved for the federal government, for the center, all the other powers are reserved for the states and for the people. In other words, if it's not mentioned here, it goes to the states. So you would think that in our system, the states would have far more power over far more things than the federal government. But the simple truth is our system has become perverted. And it's become perverted in two ways, and both ways by the Democratic Party. The first way occurred under the New Deal with the reconstituted, with the kind of what was called the switch in the Supreme Court that moved in FDR's direction, partly out of fear of court packing, by the way. And this new court basically used the Interstate Commerce Clause to declare pretty much any activity, any business activity, any activity between two people. I mean, two kids could be playing marbles. And essentially what the court was saying is, well, wait a minute, where were these marbles made? One set of marbles were made in Pennsylvania, and the marbles were shipped by interstate trucks into this particular domain, and therefore interstate commerce is involved, and therefore the federal government can regulate it. There was a restaurant called Ali's Barbecue. Now, this is an actual case, and Ali basically said, I'm serving people in my barbecue. This is my barbecue. I should be able to do whatever I want. And the court said, no, you don't. Why? Because the meat that you serve in your barbecue is shipped in on trucks from out of state. So this is interstate commerce. So you have to do what the federal government says. So the combination of New Deal laws, and by the way, later civil rights laws. Let's remember one of the striking things about our civil rights laws, particularly the Civil Rights Act of 1964, is it outlaws not just public, but even private discrimination. So the Civil Rights Act is basically saying that even if you are kind of in your own home, or if you decide to rent a room in your house, you are, in a sense, covered by civil rights laws because they cover private activity. So what you have here is the roots or the foundation of the Leviathan state, of the state in which the federal government has virtually uncontrolled domain over people's lives. And the 10th Amendment then becomes, well, close to a dead letter. And this is, a very, an all too brief history of the 10th Amendment. But unfortunately, what we have seen driven by the Democrats is a move to greater and greater centralization of authority and centralization of power. Now, by the way, I completed last week my 100th podcast, kind of a big landmark for me. And I'm now into sort of my second century, you might say, of podcasts. By the way, I don't know if you've heard them all or kind of jumped in some at some point in the middle, but all my podcasts are up. They're up on Apple in audio and Spotify and Google. They're also up in video on YouTube and Rumble. And so you can actually go back and listen to or watch the old ones. It's really kind of cool because the podcasts form a sort of fabric unto themselves. Each one is self-contained, but they also tie together certain themes that are of enduring interest to me, but also enduring importance to the country. So I hope you take advantage of this experience as we push forward, as we keep our eye on this administration and all the stuff they're doing. All covered up, by the way, with this goofball in the White House who doesn't really know where he is, looks idly around, and every now and then ejaculates with unexpected fury. Come on, man!
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com.